Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, it's one of those times, Jem, it's one of those greatest times in the podcast. I know these are always our favourite episodes. Listen to the bells ringing in the background as it is time for an argument. And Jem, I'm going to be honest, this argument, well, why don't you first of all tell us what the argument is?
Yeah, well, okay, about 30 seconds ago, before we started recording, it turned out I'd accidentally thrown a spanner in the works here. The idea of this one is to have an argument about the greatest warrior in history, meaning, you know, an actual person warrior rather than just an entire army. Because we kind of did that a while ago, you know, we ended up sort of both agreeing on that one. It was the Mongols we went for. So that I thought, but, you know, is there somebody with just such great martial prowess that we're going to sit there and go, ooh, an army? Not just a general, like Napoleon led lots of armies, but physically himself, he was not much of a fighter. But there have been some remarkable fighters in history. So, Greg, do you have anybody that you can come up with off the top of your head?
Okay, let's just go very quickly into what just happened behind the scenes here, because Jem said this to me and he said, so, you know, as in an actual person, not an army. And Jem sends me a message with his ideas of the topics a little bit in advance, gives me a chance to prepare. And I'd glanced at that and I'd looked at it and I read an army, not just a warrior, not an individual. And so I've prepared the wrong argument. So what I'm going to suggest, Jem,
who had you picked in terms of army?
I was going to be talking about the Hittites, actually, as someone that doesn't really get very much. So you know,
I was going to expect that.
I know, wouldn't that have been a great discussion? But it's not the discussion we're having. So what I suggest, Jem, is why don't you tell us who you've picked and give us a brief explanation of who you picked while I continue to rack my brains and Google and see who I'm going to bring to the table.
Quick, Google top 10 warriors in history. Okay, I'm going to read out. So you'll have plenty of time, although you'll probably pay no attention to this because you're going to be frantically clicking away. I got a little story. This is actually from Forgotten History. When I first discovered this guy, I just thought, wow. So listen to this. The title of it is The Greatest Swordsman in History. Okay. He was technically a Ronin, which means a masterless samurai. Little fact for you there, the very famous movie Seven Samurai, none of them are samurai because they have no masters. It should have been called The Seven Ronin. But anyway, he was called Miyamoto Musashi. Born around 1584, he had his first duel at the age of 13 and won. He had his second when he was 16. While neither opponent was a sword master, it was obviously a pretty good start to a career that would stretch decades, okay? So, Musashi wasn't a typical Japanese warrior. For one thing, he had some kind of skin condition, possibly eczema, but we're not quite sure, which made him ugly. Everybody agrees that he was ugly. And shockingly for a samurai or ronin, he was scruffy, which is not what you tend to think of when you think of Japanese. Not to mention, he was also quite often late for duels, something that was regarded as, again, disgraceful in feudal Japan. What was even more controversial is that quite often he fought with a bokken, which is the wooden training sword, okay? And what he would do, he would tend to knock his enemies unconscious, even though they were armed with a sword, okay? So to lose a duel against a man wielding a training weapon was, if you like, a fate worse than death for your average samurai. Now, two clashes in particular make his reputation. Around the age of 21, Musashi went to Kyoto to challenge the head of the Yoshioka school, a training camp of some of the best swordsmen in Japan. Musashi arrived late and he won with a bokken, concussing the master of the school and humiliating him in front of all his pupils. The master's brother sought revenge and a second duel ensued, which Musashi also won. By now, Musashi had caused a lot of trouble and stirred up a great deal of bad feeling in Kyoto, but the school's swordsman got him to agree to a meeting near the Ichijoji Temple, where they planned to ambush him and force him into a third duel. However, on this occasion, Musashi arrived early, saw the host of swordsmen waiting for him, and rather counterintuitively surprised them when he attacked them on his own. Exactly how many men were waiting is unknown, but the number is as high as 80, although more realistically, it was probably in their 20s, but we're still talking about one man fighting at least 20 trained samurai, okay? So Musashi recounted how he had to draw his secondary sword. You may notice with samurai, they got the main katana and they got the shorter sword. So he actually had to use both swords to protect himself. And he carried out this onslaught single-handedly. Well, seriously outnumbered, he finally fought the swordsman to a standstill, having killed many of the finest in the school, okay? Musashi would have been automatically considered the greatest swordsman of his generation had it not been for the lethally efficient Sasaki Kojiro, who was everything Musashi wasn't. He was noble, refined, and clinical. Kojiro was a master of the Nodachi, which is a two-handed samurai sword, much longer than the one you're thinking of right now. It was inevitable that the two would finally meet for a duel, and that took place in 1612 on the beach of Funajima Island. And Musashi was late as usual, had no formal headscarf, so he used a dishcloth to tie back his hair, and forgot his bokken, so instead improvised by whittling down an oar from the boat. The duel was settled by a simultaneous strike from the two masters. Now, this does, I appreciate, everything I've just said sounds like you've made this up. This is, Jem's just been watching a samurai movie and just pretended it's real. This is real. This is all real. It's well documented, okay? So it's all settled with a simultaneous strike from the two masters. Kojiro's blade was close enough to cut the dishcloth from Musashi's head, but at the same time, Musashi had brained Kojiro with the oar. It turned out Musashi knew that Kojiro was so well drilled in all the weapons in Japan that he would never have deliberately positioned himself within striking range of Musashi. Musashi therefore calculated that to stand a hair's breadth within the opponent's reach with the Nodachi, while Kojiro had misjudged the length of Musashi's DIY bokken and paid for the error with his life. These are just two of his most famous encounters. He travelled for years around Japan fighting duels, honing his skills, and was, you know, nobody argues that he was not only the best swordsman of his generation, but the best swordsman ever, and samurai are considered the best swordsman in the world, okay? So in 1615, after perfecting his swordsmanship, he became a construction supervisor, overseeing the building of Akashi Castle, among others. Later, he was known as a philosopher and writer and artist and sculptor, and Musashi has actually written a book about how to be a great swordsman and linked it with Eastern mysticism as well. So this is a warrior poet, and pretty much there have been multiple movies made about him, comic books have been made about him in Japan. You say Miyamoto in Japan, everyone knows exactly who you're talking about, and yet in Britain, pretty much unknown. He is going to beat anybody you've got, unless you're going to turn around and say they got an AK-47, but that doesn't make a great warrior. So there you go. Good story. Would you at least agree with that, Greg?
I would agree with a good story. And actually, you put me in somewhat of a difficult position, because I will be completely honest. Had I picked up the correct message, had I read your message correctly about, you know, we're going to choose the greatest single warrior in history, I probably would have gone for exactly the same person. And that seems like I'm now, you know, I'm cheating. I have, you know, I got another solution, someone that I might have gone for if we'd phrased it slightly differently.
Tell me your angle then.
Who I would have gone for sort of as the greatest knight in history, something along those lines, another great warrior. I have another one in my mind. But here's the thing about your choice, is that when you said single warrior, that was actually somebody that immediately popped into my head. And this takes us back, probably 12, 13 years now.
To little Greg.
I know, to young Greg. Greg just fresh out of school. And one of the things that I did, it made me slightly longer than that, probably when I was about 18, I actually went and did a stage combat course. I went up to, I think it was the British Association of Stage and Screen Combat. They do various courses, but they'd organise this weekend. And the idea of this particular weekend was range. It was diversity. You go along to, you know, you go along to most stage combat courses and they will teach you, okay, this is how we fight with a rapier so you can be in a pirate movie. This is how you fight with a rapier and a dagger so you can be in a pirate movie. This is... This is how you fight with a short sword so you can be in a medieval movie. This is how you fight with a hand and a half broadsword so you can be in a medieval movie. No. You're not likely to be cast in a Japanese movie, are you? So, but
so I don't know. You could be cast as Jesus, as we found out.
Although we have found that out. Although very rarely seen with a katana. But but actually, this particular weekend, although the wooden one, I mean, he could make it himself. But this particular weekend, they decided to do a course deliberately showing a great deal of range stuff that you don't normally learn. You know, there was some of the normal stuff. There was the use of knife. There was a knife fight, learning to a knife fight. One of the interesting ones was Tai Chi. We did a little bit of Tai Chi during one of these sessions. We did about an hour of Tai Chi, and you see all of these businessmen and things. You see all these images of them. They're doing their Tai Chi in the park on the way to work. And if you've ever done Tai Chi yourself, it is very, very slow, gentle, almost yoga-like thing. And we kind of went through this, and we got to the end, and then it was shown to us how most of these Tai Chi moves are actually a form of, and once you actually got these moves down, you can actually use certain of these Tai Chi moves for self-defense. And we were actually taught to build up a fight based around that. We did a hatchet fight, we did tomahawks, we did all sorts of odd little bits and pieces, but one of the weapons that we got to use was the bokken, was the wooden training sword. And at that point in time, we were learning the basics of that. And there are certain basics to that that you have to know. And one of the basic principles of fighting with a bokken was that we were taught was attack and defense are not two separate things. If you're normally involved in a sword fight, you know, you have your parries and your thrusts, as it were. You have somebody attacks you, you block that blow, and then you go for an attack. Or you're going to attack someone, they've blocked your blow, you're likely to have to come back and defend yourself. But the idea behind the style of fighting that we were taught with the bokken was that every attacking move flows into a defensive move, and every defensive move becomes an attacking move. And so the whole thing works together. And the idea is to keep its simplicity itself. And if you do it right, that first person who attacks you, they can swing their sword at you. And if you get that first move right, it will only actually take you one move to defend and strike back in one go and finish off your opponent. And we actually learn at that point in time about your warrior and about the fact that he would often fight just using the bokken against people with steel swords. The idea being that most of his fights, more than just he beat them using a wooden sword, he beat them in one blow. It was one move. It was he would wait for them to attack. They would make their first attack. And he was so well trained in this movement of defense to attack that they wouldn't get a chance to have their second attack in. He would block and he would knock them out immediately. And I believe sometimes, and I could be wrong because I'm half remembering this, I believe sometimes even killed them with that one blow, because you think this is still quite a sharp piece of wood swinging towards you. It's not going to cut you, but if that whacks you around the neck or something, it's going to do you an awful lot of damage. And so if I was going to look at a warrior from history that I'd heard about, that I knew was real and everything else, I think that probably would have been the one I plumbed for from that particular instance. And it's interesting that's the one you've gone for. And for me, I would have been desperately Googling Japanese warrior killed people with wooden sword one blow or something like that. You know, I would have been desperately trying to Google this person. So with that in mind, you have me immediately at a major disadvantage because I'm probably going to hold up you as the winner, but just so we have an alternative.
Just before you go into that, and I'm not about to start crowing about victory or anything, but I think we mentioned this before, but it's just worth sort of pausing on. Different cultures have different people that they look back at history and think are cool. So in Japan, there's no argument about it. Samurai are cool. But what's happened is over the centuries is it's leaked over to the West, and we now also agree that they're cool. But then in Europe, if you're looking at something historical, we're probably going to go for a knight in shining armor. And then in America, because they didn't have either of those things, they'll probably go for a cowboy. There are just certain like mythological, almost legendary type warrior types in various times, like Spartans, I guess, if you're going for the ancient world and in the West, or particularly if you're Greek, you're probably going to go Spartan warrior. So there are just people who almost sort of transcend history. To give you an idea, recently there's a huge video game conference exhibition thing in America called E3, where they say, here are all the new video games that are coming out. And there's one called Ghost of Tsushima, I'm pretty sure is how you say it, which is you play a samurai. And it's actually at the time when the Mongols tried to invade Japan. So we're in the 1200s. Most of the samurai stuff you tend to see is around about 1600s. This is about 400 years earlier. But it's, again, they've got the katana and they've got the sort of the coolie style hat on. And it's just the video game imagery is beautiful and lush, and it's like I saw it and I thought, okay, I may also like history and video games, but this is clearly being seen to have a big enough market that millions of dollars have been invested in this, and people who've never previously talked about samurai online on YouTube channels will be going, oh, this looks amazing, showing you just the inherent cool of, you know, the samurai. But then earlier on, there was Kingdom Come Deliverance this year, another video game where fundamentally you get to play a knight in shining armor. So there are just these certain warrior types that get the sort of hit a sweet spot, as it were.
And I think that's right. And it's that way it moves. And spoiler alert, if anybody is watching the TV series Westworld and hasn't yet seen the first series, the original film Westworld with Yul Brynner many, many years ago, as you say, that featured Westworld, which is the world with the cowboys and everything else in it, but that one also featured medieval world and Roman world. And I think that we can all agree that those are the huge cornerstones of history. As you say, if you want cool in this country, it's going to be those knights from history. And we've spoken before about the Romans. Again, spoiler alert, stop listening for the next minute if you're not up to date with Westworld. I'm not up to date. I've only got to the end of series one. But I thought it was really interesting at the end of series one of Westworld, and this isn't a major plot point, but we do see going through that they are developing other worlds within the concept of the Westworld thing. And one of those that they're developing now, rather than being Roman world or medieval one being the first one we see, it is samurai world. And so that speaks again to what you're saying there, that suddenly there is this cultural drift over towards this idea. And from us, that's fantastic, because we always say it's nice if we can get out of these regular pieces of history, these bits we see every single time. And it's nice if we can then move on and start to expand. And when these little bits come out and about, it's really nice to be able to bring those in, talk about those a bit more, for those to evolve and become part of the history and everything else that goes along with it.
Now, I've seen a number of sort of videos and documentaries were saying who is the greatest sort of warrior cast in all of history. And it almost always pretty much boils down to Spartans versus samurai. In the sense that, and indeed, there was a game last year called For Honor, where you could either play a Viking, a knight, or a samurai. Clearly, those three people never actually existed interacted in history, although you did get a moment where Vikings technically fought knights in like 1066. But anyway, but it does show you there are just these sort of certain sort of cool people. But if you look at knights and Vikings for a moment, they could be fierce, but they weren't sort of trained and honed in the area of combat. Some people go, hang on, knights were trained. Yeah, but they were also the nobility. They you know, their existence wasn't just to be a knight. They were also busy having feasts and going out hunting and things like that. Whereas the purpose of a samurai and the purpose of a Spartan soldier is they trained all the time for war. You could definitely argue that the Spartans were better trained than the samurai. And if you like, the Spartans fought dirty. The samurai were kind of good at sticking to certain established rules, although I've just used Miyamoto Musashi to show you how he was a samurai who broke the rules and one of the reasons why he won. But the thing is, the Spartans, by and large, they worked well in groups. It was the Spartan phalanx that was feared even more than just a Spartan on their own. And the Spartans were brutal against men who didn't obey the orders and didn't keep the cohesion of the overall unit. Whereas samurai, yes, fought in armies, but they were also sort of wandering Ronin who did one-on-one duels, and Spartans just didn't do that. If you like, you know, the samurai walking around like looking for trouble with his sword is pretty much the same thing as the lone gunman in the Wild West, sort of like roaming from place to place, being a sharpshooter kind of guy. So, you know, there's absolutely a bit of DNA, and the two have riffed on each other. Akira Kurosawa, arguably the greatest Japanese director ever, he did Seven Samurai, and that was turned into The Magnificent Seven. He did a movie called Yojimbo, and that got turned into A Fistful of Dollars. So, you know, you get all these things, but he himself was influenced by the Wild West movies of the 30s and 40s, and particularly John Ford movies. So you have the West influencing the East and the East influencing the West, and, but the fundamental idea of this lone hero warrior, you dress them up any way you want to, call them either a cowboy, samurai, or knight, and it works. It's something that interestingly, immediately, you're interested in that kind of story. Fair?
I think that is very fair to say. And here's the thing, Jim. We are now 21 minutes into this podcast, and so far, we have only talked about your side of the argument. And so...
Sorry.
And so, well, no,
well, you said I'd won. So
I was going to say, it's not really your fault because you have won. But here's the one little thing that I found quite interesting, because I went straight for right. Okay, gone for this one person. That would have been my first choice, I think. My second thought when I think about great warriors and great fighters would actually be a knight. And the knight that it would be, Jim, I'm sure you're familiar with, is William Marshall.
Absolutely. Great choice.
Great choice. And the thing about William Marshall is he is very contrary to what you have described a knight as, or at least he starts off. Obviously, he finishes his life as the Earl of Pembroke, regent of all England and everything else. But for much of his life, he was landless. He starts out as a landless knight, traveling around from tournament to tournament to try and make his money. I always think of him at that stage as being a bit like The Knight's Tale, you know, the Heath Ledger film. You know, this penis guy who's going around, who's going around. Yeah, only good. Yeah, who's going around and traveling from place to place and fighting, doing these tournaments to make money to live. And as a result of the skill, as a result of the prowess he receives, he actually then rises up through the ranks. He actually fights alongside Henry II. He becomes a major player in the political and in the royal movement. As I say, he ends up becoming regent. One of the really fun moments, I think, for him, one of the things that sets him apart, because again, you're talking about this samurai who doesn't seem to fit any of the conventions with the samurai, and that's, you know, something was really stands him out. That's why we know him as a warrior. William Marshall, he was a knight, but again, he was lower born. There are some suggestions that one of the reasons he features less prominently than perhaps he should in a lot of areas of history is that he was kind of kept down because he wasn't of that knightly stature. He wasn't of that bearing that we would normally expect. But the idea that he could travel around, but one of the moments that I particularly enjoy from the story of William Marshall was he had fought in the past alongside Henry II. He had got involved in various battles at various points in time. He had to decide whether to fight alongside the king or alongside what he himself believed to be right. It faced various little questions like this. But there was this moment in 1183 when William Marshall decided to rejoin the court. But here's the interesting thing is Henry II was going to be fighting his son. And Marshall decided that he wanted to join the son, not Henry II. He wanted to join Henry the Young King, as he's known. And William Marshall actually went to Henry II and asked permission to join his son against him. And Henry II let him do it, gave permission. The suggestion being that Henry II thought that William Marshall was this noble person, was this person that would do what was right. And I think there's suggestions made. Obviously, we don't know what was in another person's mind in history, but there's suggestion made that Henry II quite possibly wanted William Marshall at the side of his son so that William Marshall might just nudge him back away a little bit from getting involved in too many wars and too many battles. But I think he would have been my second choice. And he's someone that if you'd come out with, I think I would have been able to top. But bottom line here, Jim, is I've presented what I'll be honest is a character that I think it's probably worth us looking at again another time and in another context. But at this time in this context, I think that you've just knocked it out of the park with your choice. As I say, a warrior that I'd heard of. I like the fact you've brought him in because, again, it's a little bit embarrassing to me that this is a story I've heard of. This is Knight I've heard of. Sorry, Knight, a samurai soldier that I've heard of. I knew the story. He is incredibly cool. He was a great warrior. And this is a story I heard, as I say, sort of 13, 14 years ago. And yet I would have had to just Google, as I say, wooden sword, samurai, won lots of fights, something like that, because I wouldn't have known his name. And the fact that most stories I know and I've heard, I would know the name. The fact that I wouldn't have known that name is a little bit embarrassing. And that's another reason why I'm going to just sort of hand victory straight to you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. There's a dramatization of his life. He's played by Toshiro Mifune, who's the classic guy who's in all the Akira Kurosawa movies, although these weren't directed by Akira Kurosawa. And interestingly, although they were made about the same time, they haven't dated as well. But I've sat down with my eldest son and we've watched all three of them. They're in color, unlike the Akira Kurosawa ones. They are in Japanese. But particularly the second one opens with this amazing fight with this guy. And again, you don't see this in Britain, in like any martial arts fighting, that kind of thing. But this guy seems to have a fairly standard Eastern Asian weapon, which is basically a spiked metal ball on the end of a long chain. I'm not talking about a mace or a morning star. I'm talking at the end of a long chain, so it can be whipped around, it could be spun. It's a lethal looking thing, and so Musashi has to work out how to sort of get his way around that, and that's at the beginning of the second movie of three, and it does finish with that big showdown with Kojiro on that beach. It's, you know, if you want to see a glorious epic and you're willing to watch subtitles, do a Google search, Toshiro Mifune Musashi movie. I think it's called just Samurai. I could be wrong, though. Don't quote me on that. But yeah, so there's stuff out there. But William Marshall, great choice. I'm a huge fan of his as well. I'm not sure he's turned up in an awful lot of movies, though, but he would make a great film. Just a shame that hasn't sort of, if it has happened, it's probably been some sort of shonky 1940s one. Maybe he is in Knight's Tale as well. Maybe he's the trainer or something, but that is certainly not a great movie. Anyway,
I think like a man with a bocken, you have come in there, one blow, simple swipe, you've taken victory. I do hand victory over to you. Yes, so what have you got to plug for us today, Jim?
Oh, I think I'm just going to say books. I've written lots of them. I've got 7 published, 2 self-published. You can get them all through the Condensed Histories website, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. If you go to condensedhistories.com/gems, there you will find a link to all of Jem's books.
Yeah, if you like the sort of my general style, people say I tend to write the way I talk. So if you want something fun and engaging, pick a topic that you like the look of, and off you go.
And I am going to do a little plug. I mean, many people will have seen Cowboys versus Aliens, which I think was very, very popular. I would like to do a big plug for my big movie coming out next year. My big movie next year now is going to be Samurais versus Spartans, because I think there's a lot of money to be made in putting Jem's 2 favorite warrior races in the world face to face against each other.
Greg, I can help you on that. I believe Chris Pratt has signed to be in a big movie next year. And it's, I think it's based on a comic called, I'm not making this up, Cowboy Viking Ninjas.
Cowboy Cowboy, Viking, Ninja. Okay,
come
of
on,
course
that's
I
just
am.
Lots of cool words smashed together. I mean, Chris Pratt. I'm going to see that.
You're not even going to bother writing a script for that, are you? Anyway, in all seriousness, my plug, I'll tell you what, while you're over at condensedhistories.com, checking out condensedhistories.com/gems to find all the gems book, do have a little scroll around the site as well and see what I'm up to throughout the year. And in the meantime, thank you all very, very much for listening. Please make sure you do take the time to leave us a little review. Thank you very, very much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And we will be back next Tuesday with a full episode, and we will be back on Friday with another Fast Five. But for now, thank you for listening. Goodbye, and take care.